بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. It's a great pleasure to be alive another year to be able to address you. It's been now several years I've been coming here regularly. And as long as Allah Ta'ala gives me the strength, I shall try to continue to do so. Very sensitive subjects are usually chosen for me to discuss. And I feel it's my duty to help, even in a small manner, if I can. And the subject that was chosen for me for this year may sound somewhat abstract, but it concerns the concrete life of all of us every day and night. And the title of it is Sacred Harmony, Islam, Man, and the Order of Nature. This is dealing with Islamic view of our relation to God's creation and, of course, the environmental crisis, which is now everywhere around us. Let me begin with an introduction I always do to try to clarify our terms. What is harmony? We all feel that we know what it is, but no one knows how to define it. If your daughter is wearing a dress to go to a party, the mother will tell her that, oh, this, the color of this skirt is not in harmony with the blouse, change it. If you hear two different sounds, they sound so harmonious, or they sound out of harmony. We have an innate sense of harmony in space, in time, in sound, and even in taste. You say some types of food are in harmony with other types of food. And now, if to us, or this is an English word coming from Latin, what is the Arabic word that most corresponds to it? We have a word in Arabic which, like the word harmony, is used in daily life. It's used in poetry, it's used in music, because of course in the West the word harmony most of all makes us think of music. And that word is nazm, or nizam, which is a very famous Arabic word, and it means primarily order, things being in the right place. And by virtue of things being in the right place, they're in harmony, according to Islamic view. And that is why we talk about nazm al-alam, the order of the world, which also means the harmony of the world. And it's a very important Islamic ideal to remember, inculcated through the various Islamic languages, starting with Arabic itself, into Muslims for generations. That harmony is related to following the order in which God set things. That is why there are another set of words which are already related, also related to it, and which deal more with God's side of this, of, you might say, the equation. The word balance, mizan, one of the key words of the Arabic language in the Quran. God has created the mizan, the balance, and this mizan has meanings all the way from the 3 pounds of apples you buy in a shop from the fruit seller, and he uses a balance to put 3 pounds weight and you buy it, all the way to the mizan al-amal, many famous books have been written in Arabic with that title, which are the way in which God judges our amal, our actions in the other world, in the divine mizan. And everything in between. The word mizan is a very, very key term for understanding the Islamic idea of harmony. And then related to that are words which have to do with qadr, miqdar, qadr. Miqdar means quantity, but it also means correct proportion. God says in the Quran, we created everything in its correct proportion, its miqdar. That is everything in harmony. Now, it's because of these very, very central ideas that Islamic civilization was a civilization that created remarkable harmony. And the religion itself, despite all the problems that have been created for it, both through inner weakness and outer weakness and confrontation and modernism, fundamentalism, all these errors of the modern world, despite all of that, you still see some of that. Always try to base religion on balance, that is Islam itself, on balance. Balance between a human being's inner and outer need. Balance between work and prayer. Balance between good actions and enjoyment of life, and so forth and so on. You could just go down the list. All of life is really created by Islam based on this idea. Now, this goes back to the fundamental metaphysical idea that God created the world in harmony. When the Quran says, "Ma khalaqna hadha batala," God says, we did not create the world in vain, in error, in evil. It meant that it was created in good. And goodness in the Quranic perspective, precisely harmony for things to interrelate to each other. Only God in himself is not harmony, because it's above beyond harmony. But everything in his creation is based on his harmony. All that emanates from the divine creative power is based on interrelationship and harmony, beginning with the creation of the primordial pair of Adam and Eve, who were created actually out of one being originally, and in harmony of one reality, the human reality. And although on the human level we do not have harmony, I shall get to that, in many levels, including male-female relations. In principle, metaphysically, it was based on harmony. Now, this is emphasized very much in the Quran by the repetition over and over again of not only the verses of the Quran, the Word of God, being a sign of God, ayah, but also that the phenomena of nature are also ayat, are called ayat. And the Quran explicitly says in chapter 31, you shall show them as signs, ayatana fil afaqi wa fi anfusahim, upon the horizons and in the world and within their souls, hatta yatabayyana lahum annahu al-haq, until it becomes evident unto them that is the truth. So the world is created actually by God in such a way that his signs are everywhere. And signs of God cannot be disharmonious. Whenever we look at God's creation, there's incredible harmony. Put our own ugly buildings aside, fast roads and ugly cars and factories and smoke that we have created aside, and look at the beautiful primordial nature of Canada, one of the last parts of the world that is left, that very beautiful, expansive natural site. It's a remarkable harmony that pervades over it. Whether it be the beauty of the spring or the fall, the cold of the winter, heat of the summer, the peaks of the great mountains of the Rockies, the vast plains underneath, they are in an incredible harmony, which makes possible, of course, the cycle of life of so many creatures. Now, in Islam, although harmony is emphasized so much, as I've just pointed out, there is a distinct indication of harmony within man and his society, as well as in the world outside. We are not responsible for creating harmony in the world of nature. God does that. Look at a little bird chirping away at your window, picking up a little speck of wheat that has fallen on the ground and taking it to his child in the nest in the tree. The remarkable harmony, even the flight in the air, the relationship between the air, her wing, the amount of food material in the little speck that she has picked up, the relation between herself and the other creature in the tree. Just to think of this little episode in your life, you will find out the grandeur of God's creation, which is so much emphasized in Islam, and the question of this harmony. It is not accidental that two of the cardinal chapters, surahs of the Quran, are related to two insects, the bee and the ant. The chapter on the ant, are of course also on the spider, but especially the chapter bee and the ant, there's a reference over and over again to this incredible wonder that the harmony placed by God in His creation takes place and relates things together. So I should put that aside for a moment and come to a harmony in human life. Now, harmony in human life is different from harmony in nature. It's time for us Muslims who are just sleepwalking, following whatever the West does and all of its errors, to really open up our eyes and look at the reality of things, and look at the reality of our own tradition. Look at this very important point, that on the one hand, God is the creator of all things. He is Al-Qadr, absolute omnipotence, absolute power. His irada, His will, dominates over all things. At the same time, we are free not to follow Him. If we were like that little bird, or like that tree on which the nest sits, it would all be saints. There would be no need for prophets. We would be by our nature perfect Muslims. But God has given us free will. And therefore the question of the possibility of destroying harmony. And that is why the Quran emphasizes so much, first of all, the creation of inner harmony within ourselves. The cardinal teaching of all religions in their spiritual aspect, and emphasized so much in Islam, that the reform of the world must begin with the reform of ourselves. We cannot create harmony and balance in the world out there and not be balanced within ourselves. This hectic, chaotic world in which we live, all of the pollution, industrialization, overpopulation, poverty, extremes of wealth and wealthy and poor people, and destruction of rivers and mountains and so forth, and the sea, killing of all the fish in the seas now, poisoning them. All that we see is because we can do it. It's because God has given us the freedom not to be in harmony. It's a very, very important issue to understand. And therefore, He's put the responsibility of choosing harmony on our shoulders. As the Quran says, He presented the most precious and difficult of all gifts to a mountain, this and that, they all refused. Only man accepted the weight of the amana of God, the trust of God. Innahu kana zaluman jahula. This verse follows with his two adjectives pertaining to man. Innahu kana zaluman jahula. We were stupid. We were stupid to have accepted this weight. This weight was really the weight of free will. The amana of God, once we accepted it, means that we could also reject it. The fact that the trees and the sky did not accept it meant that they remained true to their nature. They remained the sky and the tree. There's a remarkably beautiful poem of Hafiz. Most of you come from the subcontinent of India. There's not a person in this room, the subcontinent, whose grandfather did not know the Diwan of Hafiz well. You're the first generation of people from South Asia who don't know the poetry of Hafiz. I'll quote one poem, which really summarizes in a beautiful way. It says, Asman bar amanat natawanest kashid, qur'e fal binam man bichare zadam. The skies could not bear the weight of God's amana, but that they cast a lot in the name of poor myself. Cast a lot in my name. This very, very beautiful poem. This means that we have accepted an incredible responsibility by virtue of being human. Also opportunity to know God, to speak to God directly, to be a mirror in which God reflects his own names and qualities, to know the divine reality in an active way, but also the danger of falling away, and therefore the possibility of falling out of harmony. Just imagine this scene, I hope inshallah it doesn't happen, but it could, just imagine it, that you would do something terrible, and next at this time, all human beings would be oppressed on the surface of the earth. All the filth in St. Lawrence Waterway and Hudson River, all the desalination of Atlantic, all of these that are occurring within a few decades will disappear. The world of nature will return to its own balance. It's a terrible thing to say, but this shows the significance of our responsibility towards guarding the harmony which God has placed in his creation, including in us. Whenever, in fact, we're not in harmony within ourselves, we're not happy. When we exaggerate, even if you have a meal and we eat too much, we get a stomachache. We must preserve a balance, we must preserve a harmony. Happy are those whose soul is in harmony. And there are many poems and hadiths that have been mentioned along this line. And the structure of the Sharia, Islamic law, is based on the application of harmony, except on the social plane. It does not deal with psychological, metaphysical, spiritual elements, which tasawwuf deals with, but the structure of society. The Sharia is based in a remarkable way on harmony. It tries to create balance, mizan, and harmony between various professions, various classes of society, various responsibilities, various economic functions, social functions. And the whole idea of haq and huquq in the Sharia sense, because this word has many, many meanings, which means the right of various creatures, is based on remarkable harmony that God has placed in his creation. Every creature has its haq. Every creature has its right by virtue of being the creature that God has created. A spider does not have the haq of an eagle. The eagle has the haq of having the sky to fly in, because God has given it those wings. The spider has the haq of having the space to spun the web that God has made it possible to spun. And so is it with us as human beings. But the Sharia gives us a haq and a plural huquq, which are in remarkable harmony. Always, first of all, combined with the harmony of responsibility. I've been saying recently, often to repeat, because so much talk about human rights. Human rights in Islam come after human responsibilities. The harmony of Islamic society is based on this truth that we have no human rights without human responsibilities. Muslims are not against human rights, as Westerners say. They're against the human rights which negates human responsibility. Because whatever rights we have is given to us by God, and by virtue of that, God has placed certain responsibilities upon us, and there must be a harmony between those two. Otherwise, the whole of society and its relation with God will break. If I say I have this right, independent of God, I don't care what God says, I've broken that balance, that harmony which is essential to human society. And then in a most subtle way, I don't have to go over it in this short lecture, but in a more subtle way, you have in Islamic society certain balances, certain hudud, certain limitations that are set, that are not there to enslave, but to create harmony with different parts of society. So society functions harmoniously. And in traditional Islamic society, it wasn't like modern society, where everyone is unhappy. Because everyone wants to be what he or she is not. Everybody is trying to climb a ladder. And therefore, nobody is happy on the rung of the ladder of sin. In Islamic society, isn't it that there was nobody who did not go from being a peasant's son to being a Sheikh al-Islam of a great city? Yes, spiritual knowledge, there was a vertical ascent. But society was created in such a way that different activities in society were respected for their own, and people were happy with being with what they were. A baker 500 years ago in Cairo, in Khan Khalili Bazaar, was happy with being a baker. He didn't want his son to become an electrical engineer so he wouldn't have to do baking again. He wanted his son to be a baker. That's why the continuity of the crafts and the arts over centuries in the Islamic world. Certain tradition, I'll just give you one example, the great Shahnai player of India, Bismillah Khan. They have been playing and making the Shahnai, the beautiful instrument, 500 years, from the 15th century on, in one family. I'll just give you one example. This continuity that existed that helped preserve the balance of life and not make people excessively aggressive, excessively wanting, always unhappy, always feeling deprived, and so forth and so on, was all related to this balance that Islam tried to create through the idea of harmony of the various parts of human society. But now I come to something that was much more subtle. And I've been speaking about it for decades, and now everyone is catching on. I said this not because of myself, but as a Muslim, and this is the one field in which we Muslims took the first step, and that is the creation of the awareness of the environmental crisis. Some of you are my students and friends, no doubt that I gave the Rockwell Studies lecture there in Chicago in 1966, 50 years ago, where I predicted the environmental crisis because of man's loss of the spiritual vision of nature. At that time, nobody talked about the environmental crisis. It was called the ecological crisis. And 6 months later, Lynn White gave his famous talk in Washington. He was in the audience in Chicago. He was in Chicago on the historical roots of our ecological crisis, which began the discussion of the environment. Anyway, I've been dealing with this for over 50 years, and I come back at every occasion possible to this issue, because this is an issue that's extremely important for the Islamic world, and in which the Muslims living outside of Darul Islam can play a especially important role. Because if you live in the Islamic world, whether you live in Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Iran, Tunisia, it doesn't matter what kind of government. If you speak seriously about these matters, it will go against the government's economic policies and you'll be shut up very quickly. Governor of Egypt, it's very interesting, I'll give you an example. Governor of Egypt, in the last year or so, in order to prevent political discussion being held in Friday prayers, had ordered all the khatibs to talk about cleaning up the environment. Very neutral. But what cleaning up the environment? Don't throw your garbage into the water system. This kind of thing. We didn't need actually the khatib to tell us that. Part of Islamic law. But the deeper question, why are you destroying all the land along the Nile, which is the most fertile land, which for 1,000 years the Muslims never built on because of the inundation of the water of the Nile? All of this, why don't you say something about that? You keep passing in silence. We live in a very bad situation within the Islamic world as far as this issue is concerned. And that is why it's a double duty, I believe, upon those of us to whom God has given the opportunity and the knowledge to live in a world in which we can speak about it, to speak about it. I'm very happy that I know myself hundreds of young Muslims students who are now studying in this country, whether being my former students or friends or correspondents, but are now going to this field. We need an Islamic environmentalism. And it goes back to the understanding of how the Quran, and of course the Hadith, which is the first commentary upon the Quran and complements the sacred text, tell us about man's relationship to nature. Now, a lot of Westerners in the 19th century, when they came to India or to North Africa or different places, and they wanted to write pejoratively about Islam, they would say that Islam is naturalistic. Islam is naturalistic. And besides other things that they would say. And what they did not understand is that Christianity emphasizes the supernatural. For Islam, the natural already contains the supernatural. Nature is not purely natural. It is itself supernatural, sacred. Nature is sacred. That's why the verse of the Holy Book of Islam has the same word as the phenomena of nature. Which religion has something like that? If it were not in the Quran, some modern Muslims say, well, this is kufr, because they don't understand. Unfortunately, the extreme forms that have been created in the Islamic world, one of the first signs, both fundamental extremists and modernists, that have no interest in the Islamic view of nature. They share that completely. No interest whatsoever. It remains for the rest of us to try to resuscitate a very, very important teaching, that if there is in Islam a very, very important teaching about the relationship between man and nature. And it's amazing. A civilization which had the first city in the history of the world with 1 million people in it, the city of Nishapur, before it was invaded by Hulagu Khan, by the Mongols, and all the people were killed, and over 1 million people. And it was supposed to have been the first city in the world, before Beijing or any other city, that 1 million people in it. So it was a sedentary civilization, creating great cities. At the same time, had a remarkable philosophy of relation with nature. I'll give you a simple example. When you walk in a forest, you never see remains of animals. God has created nature in such a way that a lion comes and kills a deer and eats part of it. Then the leopard comes and eats another part. Then the smaller animal, foxes and so forth and so on. And even the dung that is left is carried away by special ants into the hole. And you never see any garbage in nature. Have you ever seen any garbage in nature? No. Nature has a remarkable cleaning system. Islam tried to emulate that, not to waste anything. Those of you who have been born or brought up in the Middle East know that very well. When we sacrifice a sheep, everything in the sheep is used, in one way or another. Even the entrails are used to make strings for musical instruments or all kinds of things. The knuckles we eat, pig knuckles are very, lamb knuckles, excuse me, are very delicious. Here they eat pig knuckles, of course, which is haram for us. But everything is used, nothing is wasted. The skin we put in our homes as carpeting. You sit on it. It was based on not wasting. And what we call recycling now was part and parcel of Islamic civilization. With so little waste. And so what we need to do is to go back to the teachings of Islam concerning the relationship between man and nature. First of all, nature is not only there to serve us, except to make possible for us to live in such a way as to know God. The only right we have to be on the top of the food chain is to transform, in fact, the whole terrestrial world into a place where the light of God shines. In a spiritual sense, the Sufis have said that the world is like a room, and man is like a window to that room. If that window is not cleansed and it's not open, the light of the sun will not shine into the room. The whole room will grow dark. The fact that there's so much chaos in the world today is due to the chaos within ourselves. The Amazon is dying. The greatest forest of the world, which is the lung of the world, is dying. Because it already died in the heart of the Brazilians who are destroying that forest. Inwardly. And so we are living in a very critical and difficult time. And we must ask ourselves this question. Why are we doing this? Why are we breaking this harmony? Why is it that we Muslims, put Christians on the side, why is it that we Muslims pay so little attention to this matter? Why is it that our educational system, rather incorporating the Islamic view of the environment, are run, of course, on the highest level by missionaries all over the Islamic world? The rich people in the Islamic world that even send their children to Muslim school. They all send them to the missionary school, Christian missionary school. And that's the great tragedy that we have. But to the extent that we can, to try to show why it is that it's significant for us to pay attention to the environment, if you're going to talk about Islam, and if you're going to talk about secularism and so forth, it still is important because we have to have a world on which to stand to even negate God. Secularists have no place else to go. And the argument given by some Muslims and Christian fundamentalists, and especially Pentecostals and people like that, that Christ is going to come any day and who cares what happens to the world? Or the Mahdi will come and the world will be rejuvenated. That is totally false from an Islamic point of view, because the hadith of the Prophet ﷺ, he said, it's a blessed act to plant a tree, even if it be a day before the day of judgment. Even if it be a day before the day of judgment, it's a blessed act to plant a tree. So we have to go back to these teachings and come back to ourselves with a sense of assurance that first of all, Islamic tradition provides a vast resource for the understanding of our relationship with nature, which is not naturalistic, it's not pantheistic, it's not panentheistic, and all of these categories which have been attributed by different Orientalists to Islamic thought is based on the idea that God, having created the world, there's no other source for the reality of the world. And since God is Al-Quddus, what that is the sacred of the capital S, there must be something sacred in his creation. And he alludes to that over and over again in the Quran. There is no sacred scripture in which nature is as present as the Quran. To be honest, as a humble scholar of comparative religion, the only sacred scripture that can compare to it is the Tao Te Ching, the sacred scripture of Taoism in China. I'm right now translating of all this is the Tao Te Ching into Persian, in my own commentary. It's going to come out soon, not in English, in Persian. And be translated soon enough. And it's remarkable because there it also talks about that. So these two sacred scriptures, but especially the Quran, the Semitic world, it speaks all the time about nature. No Muslim should forget that God swears by the tree. He swears by the sun and the moon, as Shamsu wal Qamar. He swears by various parts of his own creation. You swear by something that is valuable, that is sacred. Astaghfirullah, you don't swear by some cockroach walking in your room, or by brick in the garden. It's something that is precious. The preciousness of nature, that nature has its own way to God, that it remembers God in its own way, is very, very significant in our traditional civilization before modernism came. It was held that all creatures, without independent of us, pray to God. We have some birds that pick up water and then they go like this. We always say, it's called in Persian, Murghahat, the bird of the divine truth. Because you say every time it drinks water, it prays to God like that. All creatures pray by their very existence. And Islamic literature is full of references to this. I being a Persian, of course, though Persian literature a bit better than Arabic. And this, I think that my favorite poem of any Islamic poem concerning this, in which it comes from the, again, the Masnavi of Jalaluddin Rumi. It says, Koshki Hasti Zabani Dashti. If only creatures in existence had tongues, so they would lift the veil from this mystery of God's creation. If they could talk, they would reveal the mystery of existence itself. This is what Muslims produce. This is the refinement that they have. And this reflected in everything. As I told you, look how much in harmony, in the middle of desert, lack of water, all of these things. Traditional Islamic architecture is with the environment. How idiotic it is for us in our big cities, whether it be Tehran or Damascus or Cairo, to build glass houses, which use the maximum amount of energy to cool off. Whereas in our traditional architecture, you have the same degree of cooling off during the winter, during the summer, and warming during the winter, as if you were using millions and millions of dollars of petroleum or some other resource to cool and heat your buildings. I have a lot of experience about that. When I was president of Iran's Sanjur University, I carried out the research, and my professors carried out research on this field. And it's absolutely astounding. If the Islamic world were all to have something like Danish or English architecture, German architecture, just architecture, disband this architecture completely, create Western-style architecture, at that time, it was, that's 40 years ago, it would cost, at the price of that time, several $1 billion a year difference just to heat and cool living spaces. Our ancestors had learned about that. I could talk about agriculture, about the use of water, preservation of water, and remarkable achievements that they made in dealing with nature, and always awareness that they had a sense of responsibility. It's that which we cannot lose. And which tragically, the rise of urbanism within the Islamic world with many other factors destroyed. How many young kids do you see in big Islamic cities whose parents come from villages? They will not touch a blade of grass. They will not take a leaf off a tree. Once they come to Tehran or Cairo, as soon as they can, they take the bark of the branch of trees and break them off, and you have to have 5 policemen around every tree to protect the trees to grow. All the Islamic cities where trees have grown, the government put policemen. I remember when I was a child, the beautiful avenue that got from Tehran to Shamran with beautiful plane trees now this big. Reza Shah had put a policeman at every tree. 24 hours, every tree all the way for several kilometers to protect the trees. We have to realize this. This is because of dislocation. It's because of disorientation that young boy would not do that in the little village in which he lived. If our villages are very well protected this way. People took care of their environment. And we still have a tremendous amount to learn from the way our ancestors lived. They did not waste. They're always grateful for God's ni'mah, God's blessings. They saw the bounties of nature, not as their own, but as God's gift to them. And that gave them a sense of humility, and not everybody, of course, but most of society, a sense of humility towards God's creation. Now, we are forced by our errors, and the errors of the Western world which started the environmental crisis, to consider these matters. We have no choice. We can build 200 mosques a day in California or in New York. But that's not enough. You need Muslims who will think about these matters, study these matters, and present an Islamic point of view of this matter. And the onus of responsibility that said falls upon us who live in the West, whom God has chosen to live in the West, all of our Muslims, because we do not have the inhibitions. We do not have the inhibitions. Let me end with a story. When I was in Iran, of course, Man and Nature came out. With my very last book to be published in Persia, everybody neglected it. All the suffer are very well known in Iran. Every time I write 2 words, it's published 10 places in Tehran, even now. But this book was neglected for a long, long time. When Ayatollah Khomeini came, he did not understand this aspect of things, and he ordered all the national parks, which Iran was the first country in the world to have a national park, to be open to peasants going back, and all many rare species were killed. You just cannot imagine the catastrophe. And when the president of Iran, Ayatollah Rafsanjani, was president, he realized what a suicide this was, what a terrible thing it was. So he asked the person who was deputy prime minister in charge of the environment in Iran, who was a very close friend of mine, who was in prison, to prepare a text he wanted to read to Iranian people to revive the environmental interest. And although he was in prison, through his wife, he got in touch with me, and I wrote it for him, and he gave it to Rafsanjani, and then he read it. Practically all my words, a few sentences changed. Realizing that Iran, as the Islamic Republic of Iran, cannot do without an environmental program. And since then, a lot of other Islamic countries have now at least ministries or deputy prime ministers, Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, Egypt, Pakistan, are high levels of officials, also Indonesia, who deal with these matters. But we have a very, very long ways to go. And I think the responsibility relies, to a large extent, is based on the shoulder of people who are here and like them in Canada and the United States, who have access to what's going on in the West, the thinking that goes on in the West, and the role that we can play in formulating a correct theology, you might say, of the environment, correct relation between not only God and us as individuals, but God, us, and His creation, in which He's placed us as the guardian and custodian. Otherwise.